The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 25, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. Really nice to see you on a holiday weekend. You know, I used to think we used to do sessions on Memorial Day weekend and Labor Day weekend. And as you know, some of you may know, if you heard last week, you know that we almost didn't have a session. So, and that was not even on Memorial Day weekend, but I came to see those as the high holidays of Minnesota, and you just don't do things on those weekends. So it's really nice to see people here this weekend. It's really a lovely weekend as well, you know, the kind of weather you can enjoy anyhow. I mean, I actually do enjoy overcast weather, but boy, that doesn't move me to get on my bicycle. But something like this, I'll probably be out bicycling today. So thank you all for being here. So, and by the way, hi, Bridget. Nice to see you. Yeah, it's been a while. So good to see you. I've been thinking about, well, actually what I did is to come up with this talk, I was going through some old notebooks. And I just had, this is the title of my talk. It's Mind Song. Mind Song. And it was just that and another word that's related to it that'll come up in my talk. That's all it said. And I went, well, it's kind of interesting. And I have been thinking recently about thinking during meditation, about thoughts arising during meditation. And thoughts will arise during meditation. And we know that they will arise during meditation. That's just the way it is. But I think sometimes when we start, or before we've started meditation practice, we might think that meditation practice is not having any thoughts, that we don't, thoughts don't enter our mind. And an example I used to give, now I don't know how many people remember this TV show. I mean, it was a hit, you probably do. It was called Parks and Rec. And there were these two characters, and they were kind of odd pairing. One was played by Nick Offerman. He played Ron, and he was this kind of like conservative, kind of gruff guy, but with a soft heart. And then there was this other guy, Chris, who was played by Rob Lowe, and he was kind of a flighty guy. And Chris invited Ron to go to a meditation retreat with him, which Ron did not want to do. But he went. I can't remember why. It was a team-building exercise. And Ron went to it. And you could tell watching Ron that he had zero investment in being in that room. And when it was done, Chris asked me, he goes, how'd it go? And Ron goes, oh, it was a waste of time. I didn't think about anything the whole time I was there. And then Chris went, I've been practicing for 30 years trying to get to that place, right? And that's not what our meditation practice is. We'll think that's what it is. Again, especially when we start or before we start, but even after we start, I suspect if you really investigate what you're doing in meditation practice, that is probably still informing your practice. And it's because, like I said, thoughts arise in meditation practice. We know they will. Sometimes they come up a lot in meditation practice. So you're sitting and you realize, oh, I've been lost in thought. And you do that again and again and again and again and again and again. And you just keep doing it. Or sometimes the thoughts, I don't know how to describe this, but they get really thick. You know, they get really thick, whereas you're just lost in it. That's a state that I can get myself in pretty easily. You know, it's something I trained myself to do as a kid. We didn't have so many distractions, so how did I distract myself? Well, I just go off into my fantasy land. And you can just blot out the whole world. You just get into those thick thoughts. And then you lose track of everything for a while. And whether they're frequent, you know, you have to keep coming back to it. Or they're thick and you go, whoa, where was I? And it gets so thick, you're facing that wall. It's just right in front of you. And yet you don't really realize there's a wall in front of you. You know, it can get that thick. And then you realize, ah, there I go, right? Lost in thought again, or the thickness of the thought, and you go, maybe you tell yourself, not again. Not again. It's the 100th time I brought myself back, you know? And that actually may also show up as, holy cow, I've been sitting meditation for 20 years and I still have to bring myself back that often, or I still get lost in that kind of thickness of thought. Or maybe even you go, and this one seems like the least scolding of the lot of them, right, to ourselves, is, ah, I'm back again. And a version of that, ah, I'm back. I was lost in thought there, but here I am. Now I'm back. And that actually, if you pay attention to it, is very similar to not again, or I've been doing this for, you know, now I'm back. And we may even tell ourselves that we're not doing this, right? We may tell ourselves, it's not how I do meditation practice. I just let the meditation practice be what it is. I let the thoughts arise. And yet still treat our thoughts as impediments to our practice, right? I wasn't really practicing until I let that go. Not really practicing until I'm back here, and then I'm practicing. So we don't see that moment when the thoughts are so thick we can't see the wall, or that we have to keep coming back and back. We don't see that as practice. And so really what we're saying, by not seeing that as our practice, we're also saying that's not really reality. That wasn't really reality. Now, we may not think we're saying that, but that's what we're saying. That really didn't happen. It's kind of what we're saying. But, this is where the word mind song comes from. Now you'll know the other word that was on the same page. But our thoughts, if we can see this, this can help. Our thoughts are no different from bird song. No different from bird song. I mean, obviously they're different. Bird song is bird song and thoughts are thoughts. So in that way, they're different. But in their difference, they're absolutely the same. 100% bird song. 100% thoughts. So I like to think of thoughts as perhaps mind song. That's where mind song comes from. Just like bird song. And bird song can help us to see the absurdity with which we can treat our thoughts, right? So, for example, when we are thinking, we're meditating, sitting on the cushion, we might tell ourselves, oh, I'm lost in thought again. I've got to bring myself back. I've got to bring myself back. Or, here I am again. Here it is. Finally here. Now, would we say to a bird that's chirping out the window, stop it, you're ruining my practice. You know, we actually might. We might do that. We might go, that bird is ruining my practice, bothering me. It's distracting me. You know, we could do that with anything. We had, our blinds here can get caught a little bit in the wind, especially if the blind is a little bit below the open window, gets caught and it can do this little click, click against the windowsill. And apparently somebody said, tell the doans not to pull those things down so low because the clicking of the blinds is interfering with my meditation practice, right? So it can help us to see what it is we're doing, because it's easier for us to see how silly it is to tell a bird to stop interfering with our meditation practice than it is for us to do the same thing with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we seem to be able to do that pretty readily. But with the bird, it seems silly to do that if we really see what we're doing. And I think that bird song is a good example also, because it really does help us to see what it is that we do with things when they show up pretty readily. For example, we can take pleasure in bird song. I mean, it's pretty great. This is the time of year where we really start to hear it. And it's wonderful. You know, I was out for a walk last weekend. Beautiful day. I heard all of this. All these birds were singing, you know. And of course, I like watching birds. So I started going, oh, an oriole. I heard a northern oriole over by Lake Harriet. Oh, it's an oriole. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience with, like, maybe you don't really know what an oriole sounds like, but they have what do we call, ostentatious enough of a song that if you're actually aware that there's bird song, you might go, what is that bird? I remember this happening with, actually, there's a small little bird, cute little red bird called a house finch. And they nest in, often in the eaves of our houses. And they have a beautiful little song. And I remember years ago, before I actually started really paying attention to birds, I was downtown Minneapolis, just that right in the heart of downtown. And it was lunch, and everybody was going to the, you know, getting their lunch in, basically. And I heard this bird singing this beautiful little song, and I went, what is that? And I'm looking all around. And then I saw, it was the old NSP building downtown. I worked there, actually. And it was on a wire, a thin little wire. I don't know what they use those wires for, banners or hanging banners. But there was this, just this adorable little red bird, and he was making this beautiful song. And I just sat and I listened and I watched for a while. And eventually everybody who was passing by would just kind of slow down and try to see what I was looking at. And maybe they would hear the bird, so then they would stop and try to and see the bird sitting there. The same thing with the oriole, you know. I heard the oriole singing. I heard something called a common yellow throat, which is it's yellow. It's also black and kind of an olive drab green, but it's yellow. It's just this, it's a little warbler. And you usually encounter them like in wetlands. And so I heard a common yellow throat. But the deal with the common yellow throat is that you can hear them, but you don't usually see them. Which doesn't make sense to me because of this bright yellow bird, but it's partly because of that olive drab and the black. They actually camouflage really well, and then they're in the thick. So I'm telling you all this not to give you a lesson in birds, but just there can be great joy in hearing all of that bird song. And for me, hearing birds singing all at the same time can bring great joy to me. But bird song is also something that can annoy us, especially if we're trying to concentrate, or if we're trying to sleep, you know. I love hearing a cardinal with that bright sound. I mean, their sound is as bright as their feathers are. But if it's, and they tend to do this at this time in the morning, if it's sunrise and I'm trying to sleep, I don't want that thing doing that outside my window. Or have you, this is something I call a sparrow tree. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. Either be a shrub or a tree, and it has all of these house sparrows in it, and they're like, and you can hear the tree from, I don't know, if it was outside your window and you were trying to do something, it could easily be maddening, you know. But, and then as you get closer to it, it gets silent. And then as you walk away from it, it starts doing that again, right? Or I was in Miami earlier this year. And we saw these, at first I looked at it and went, is that a parrot? Are there parrots flying around in Miami? You know, so I have a bird app and I looked it up, and sure enough. And they're not really parrots exactly. These were, what I saw anyway, were parakeets. They're called mitred parakeets. And so that was delighted by that. I was, oh, there's parakeets flying around in Miami. And then my husband and I started paying attention, and we started realizing we weren't just like, we first saw a couple, and it seemed rare. I even pointed it out to the woman who ran, I think she owned the restaurant we were at. I said, there's parrots up there, you know? And she goes, oh, really? Huh, they're usually over there. but we realized that there are flocks of these parrots all over the place, and oh my God, did they make a racket? I mean, just shrieking, and they would get together and they'd make this sound. And then I realized that the hotel we were in, like maybe I don't know, 4 or 5 stories down. They were nesting and mating down there. And I was like, and they would make this horrible noise. And I was like, thank God they're just far enough away that we can't hear them. Because again, if they were outside my hotel window, then they would annoy me. And I'll leave one more call. This is a call more than it is a song, really. But it's the call of the blue jay. You know, that sound that they make where it's just like, it just cuts right through everything. And just that sound alone can just irritate you. You don't have to be trying to concentrate or try to sleep. It can just be the sound of that blue jay screaming, shrieking like that, you know, just seemingly piercing through your peace and calm. And they can annoy us, these bird songs, because that's how we see them. We see that here's my life. It's been going along. It's pretty calm. Everything's good. And then this bird comes along and goes, wah, you know, starts making this noise. And that's how we're treating the world. There's this thing that shows up. It's outside of me and it's intruding on my life. And that is what we're doing with our mind song. Same thing. Bird song. Sometimes it's lovely. Sometimes it's annoying. Mind song. Well, sometimes those thoughts can be very captivating, but shouldn't have those thoughts, right? So now we're seeing it as something outside of this peace and calm of this moment that's intruding on peace and calm of this moment. But it's harder to see that we're doing this with thoughts because we see them as being interior. So it's harder for us to see that we're treating it as something that's outside of us. Because we don't interpret it that way. We interpret it as something that's inside of us. And we also see our thoughts as being more intimate than birdsong. They seem to be part of us. They don't seem necessarily to be something outside of us. So it's just harder to see that we can actually treat our thoughts as being something outside of us. And in doing that, thinking our thoughts are more intimate, we're also missing out on another very important aspect of experience that I'll be touching on in just a few minutes here. And that's that bird song is just as intimate as mind song is. Bird song is just as intimate as mind song is. But we don't see that. We have this tendency to construct the world as being outside of us. So these are just some thoughts I jot down. Well, just two words. I wrote mind song, bird song. That's all I wrote. But I knew I was kind of getting at that. And recently we read a passage in Shinryu Suzuki. He's an important teacher in our lineage who founded the San Francisco Zen Center. And we're reading his book that's commentary on a very well-known Zen poem. And the book is called Branching Streams Flow Through the Darkness. And in it, he writes about birds. So, of course, I'm happy. Now, I've noticed he actually brings birds up somewhat frequently. So I'm guessing that he was in a place where he was suddenly aware of. There were probably different birds than he was used to from Japan. So he was aware of these birds. But they must have been, I don't know, living nearby. They are certainly close at hand for in his mind. But Suzuki writes this. He says, Buddhists understand a sound as something created by our mind. It's the beginning statement of that observation. Buddhists understand a sound as something created by our mind. I may think the bird is singing over there, but when I hear the bird is me already. Actually, I am not listening to the bird. The bird is here in my mind already, and I am singing with the bird. Beep, beep, beep. If you think while you are studying, the blue jay is singing above my roof, but its voice is not so good, that thought is noise. When you are not disturbed by the blue jays will come right into your heart, and you will be a blue jay, and the blue jay will be reading something. And then the blue jay will not disturb your reading. When we think the blue jay over my roof should not be there, that thought is a more primitive understanding of being. because of our lack of practice, we understand things in that way. So I just think that's such a lovely passage, right? That blue jay, as he says, it's not I am listening to the blue jay. The bird is in my mind already. And I am singing with the bird. So when we see thoughts as impediments to our practice, we're doing with our thoughts what that person that Suzuki is talking about did with the blue jay. And we're seeing our thoughts as noise rather than sound. So he makes that distinction. He says, we're seeing the thought as noise. And he actually clarifies that distinction in the same essay. He says, sound is different from noise. Sound is something that comes from your practice. Noise is something more objective, something that can bother you. If you strike a drum, the sound you make is the sound of your own subjective practice. And it all is also the sound that encourages all of us. Sound is both subjective and objective. So see the difference between sound and noise. Noise is objective. It's out there. It's that world. I'm not a part of it, right? There's that world that's out there. Whereas sound is subjective and objective, right? It's in our mind. It's in mind. And as such, Suzuki's telling us that striking a drum, and we could think of it as striking a bell here in the meditation hall. He says it's not just a sound of your own subjective practice, and it is. Anyone who strikes those bells know, you know, that bell never comes out. Maybe, Brian, you're not like this. But for me, I remember when I struck a bell, sometimes it would come out one way, and sometimes it would come out another way, and sometimes it would come out, like if I ring it, and it would be like. Then the next one, I'd be like, dong! You know, I would just ring it to kind of correct for the, and then I'd do the third one if I did three bells, and it would be sort of in a happy medium between you could barely even hear it. It was like the wind blowing through, you know, a grass field where the grass is cut really short, or it's like, you know, somebody bonging the Liberty Bell, you know, something in between that. So where it can be very subjective that way, but it's also everybody's bell, everybody's gong, everybody's knocking on the drum. And so that not just striking the drum or ringing the bell, it's also how we sit. Is our subjective practice that is also objective. How we sit is everyone's sitting. How we walk, how is it we're walking? That's everybody's walking. First time I went to New York City, I couldn't believe it. I was a fast walker. I was one of these people. I'd be walking around the Twin Cities and I'd be like, holy cow, these people, you know what I mean? I would get irritated when I go out for walks and be like going, I can't believe these people are walking so slow. Who walks that slow? I mean, my God, are they going someplace or what are they doing? You know, I just kind of have all the, then I get to New York City and I practically be trampled because people are going so fast, you know? The way we walk, we're sharing that with everyone. The way we speak, what we say, that feels very subjective to us. But just know that whenever you say something, you're sharing that with other people. How are you speaking? Where is that coming from? What are you doing? And we don't ask ourselves that, and we don't have to sit there everything we say and go, what am I doing? But you can just notice. How are you doing this? What's your intention? Subjective and objective. But the sound comes from our practice in another way too. And that, so again, we're talking noise versus sound. We think about that chattery blue jay. And when we think the blue jay is singing above my roof, but its voice is not so good. And that's so sad. Let me just say, just in defense of blue jays. Blue jays, so I thought I would look this up on my bird app, you know, because I was making a distinction between calls and songs. And what we hear the Blue Jay do are actually calls. They're less sophisticated songs, and they often have a purpose. A call often has a purpose to it, or a song, it might have a purpose, but there's a little more of a, they're longer and more intricate, and it's not associated with a particular action, you know. So a song might just be a bird singing. Now, when they do that, they might be indicating this is my territory. So just warning, I'm here. If you're going to come here, I'm already here. It could be that. It could be a mating call. And just be singing. A call has very particular things. So I was looking that up, and I thought, oh, yeah, but blue jays have songs, you know. And I looked through, and none of the things on my bird app were the blue jays' songs. And then I went, wait, they're calling all these calls, and I listened to everyone, and all of them were the annoying sounds that a blue jay makes. And I went, but they make songs. I don't know if you've heard it. They make these kind of lovely, I don't even know how to describe it, like somebody running through the harmonics of like a flute or something like that. You can hear them. And then, Rick, have you ever heard a blue jay doing its whisper bird song? The first time I heard this, I was like, what on earth is that? It was this weird, strange, beautiful thing. And I realized it was coming from a blue jay. And I was like, what is going on? I've never heard a blue jay do that in my life. I looked it up, and they call it a whisper song, is what I think they call it. And what that song is the blue jays is running through his repertoire to himself. And it comes off as this incredible song. He's running through his repertoire. So just to say, the blue jay does have some moments where they do sound lovely. But when they're going, bah, that thing, right, maybe the voice doesn't sound so good to us. Then it's noise. Unless we can let it into our heart. So this is another way that sound comes from practice. By letting the blue jay sound into our heart. Which is hard for us to do when we treat the world objectively. Because when we treat the world objectively, we're withholding ourselves from the world, really. We're kind of going, well, there's the world and then there's me. So we withhold ourselves from the world, from reality, and then there's a split between me and the rest of the world. But if we don't do that, we don't hold part of ourselves back, but we give ourselves fully to this. To this, to whatever it is, fully. This is Zazen. This is our meditation practice. If we give ourselves fully to this, however it appears, no matter how raucous it might be, there will be no noise. So to fully give ourselves to this, you can see this. There is no more noise. When there's noise, what do? Maybe... And I don't see Shirley here, but I know Shirley's got some critters in her yard that she, like rabbits, that are going to eat her plants. She's got a slingshot. And she's also got woodpeckers that peck on her house. You know, so she's got a slingshot to kind of take care of it. When we give ourselves fully to this, we hold nothing back for ourselves. We hold nothing back. We don't create that. We don't try to shoo the noise away, but rather we just welcome the sound in. And that's giving ourselves away. That's not holding onto ourselves, withholding ourselves from reality. We're giving ourselves fully. That is generosity. That is generosity. Generosity in Buddhist teachings, that's one of the six perfections of practice. One of the six perfections. The perfections. I'll just read all six of them for you in case you haven't encountered this teaching before. We do have a class that we offer from time to time on the six paramitas. And they come up and talk from time to time. But generosity, ethical conduct, patience, effort, meditation, wisdom. Those are our six paramitas. And generosity. That first one on the list, that's to fully give ourselves away. I realized I had this nice commentary on the paramita of generosity that appeared in a book that I have that's a commentary on the Diamond Sutra, which is an important teaching in Zen and in Buddhism. And it's from Lin Chi, and he's an old Chinese master going way back, over a millennia ago. And Lin Chi, this is what he has to say about generosity. He says, to practice generosity is to give everything away. This means to get rid of perceptions of self, being, life, and soul, sorrow and delusion, possession and renunciation, love and hate. The Buddha teaches us to practice generosity, to rid ourselves of all attachments within, and to benefit all beings without. By not dwelling on anything, bodhisattvas do not see the self that gives, nor do they see the other that receives, nor do they see anything given, for all three are essentially empty. By concentrating without concentrating on anything, their practice of generosity remains pure. They do not desire what they do not have, nor do they long for some future reward. When ordinary people practice generosity, they hope for some blessing or benefit. That is to practice generosity while attached to something. So that generosity that is the paramita, and what Lin Chi is helping us to see, that it is to give everything away to this, to really fully live this. So if we can practice generosity and give ourselves fully to this, then we can allow their birdsong into our hearts, or returning to meditation again, we can allow mind song into our hearts rather than treat it objectively and reject it. And then if we can do that, perhaps we can see how mind song actually helps put us in touch with that peace and calm, or that silence. So those thoughts that arise, they can actually help us get in touch with that, that chatter that we thought was impeding that silence, can actually help us to experience that silence. And I think of a teaching that, I think it was from Uchiyama, I don't remember what teacher it was, but he talked about when we're living and we're not in pain, we don't really sit and think about the fact that we're not in pain until we've experienced pain. When you experience pain, then you can really taste not in pain. But until that, we don't really think of not in pain. It's just sort of there. We just take it for granted. Same thing with that stillness, that silence. It's right here. And then we might fill it up with some chatter. And that chatter helps us to taste that silence. It helps us to taste that peace and calm. So pain helps us to feel not pain. Birdsong, right, can help us to touch that quiet, that calmness. You know, birdsong, you know, realizing that is to let the birdsong into your heart. Realizing that thoughts help us to touch that calmness, that silence. That is letting mind song into your heart, right? And that's important for us. And we really want to, when we're sitting, and when we're moving through life, we want to be clear about what we're doing. Pay attention. Listen. It's okay. It's okay if you're actually rejecting something or judging something. It's okay. Listen to that. Be with that, and maybe you can hear non-judging. Maybe you can hear peace and calmness, because that's what that's helping you to see. And you can just let that into your heart, your own thoughts, which is harder for us to do. But again, just think, mind song, bird song, it's the same. All right, those are my comments this morning. If people have observations or comments or questions, I'm open for any of those. Thank you. So what school of Zen he teaches in? Yeah, we practice Soto Zen here, and he's in that particular vein of Zen. And Soto and Rinzai Zen are the two ways that Zen are practiced. I don't know of any other contemporary way of taking up Zen. But Zen historically had, well, historically it was basically people were doing this thing, and it eventually got to be called Chan, which in China means meditation, and in Japanese Zen is meditation. And then in hindsight, they looked back and they said, oh, there are five schools of Zen. And of those five schools, two have survived. One of them is Lin Chi, that person I read, his Japanese name is Rinzai. And that's how that school is known. And that particular branch of Zen, same thing we do, we focus on meditation. We focus on studying teachings, and those teachings can be in the lineage of Zen. We have some unique teachings, like koans are unique to Zen. Rinzai uses the koans as part of their practice in a different way than Soto does. So that's probably the main differentiation between Rinzai and Soto. So we're a form of Buddhism that's called Zen that focuses particularly on meditation and certain types of teachings. And then within that, of these two schools, one of them focuses more on using koans as a method of meditating and kind of breaking through. And the other one focuses on sitting and awareness of daily life. Does that help?
Yeah.
Might have been a little technical.
Can you talk about what, go delve deeper into what exactly is a koan?
What a koan is? Sure, a koan. Now, koans, I just said that and I thought, well, everybody knows what a koan is, knowing that that's not necessarily true because I've explained those before. But koans are teachings that are often associated with Zen, and they sound like mysterious sayings, you know, or puzzles or something like that. So the one that I always give an example of, because it's one that people know, is what is the sound of one hand clapping, right? Or if tree falls in a forest, but no one's there to hear it, doesn't make any sound. And there are these kinds of teachings that are designed to wake us up to what is actually being experienced as opposed to the way we usually package or understand our teachings. They're pointing directly to reality itself. And they can be inscrutable if we try to rationally figure out what it is they're saying. If we treat them as puzzles to be solved, then they just seem crazy. So that's what a koan is, a teaching tool. Thank you. Anything else? Have people been hearing these bird songs I've been talking about? Mm-hmm. Been noticing that? You know, the thing is, too, with bird song, like right now, it's real obvious because right now the showy birds are making their noise. And it's that time of year. Birds are getting it on, you know, so they're kind of trying to make themselves sound attractive. But there really is bird song that goes on throughout the year. It's just less ostentatious, less showy, less fun to listen to. Like one of them are those house sparrows. Anyone else? Do you know what house sparrows are? They're the sparrows everybody hates. So if there's some little bird and it's kind of brown or whatever, and you hate it, it's probably a house sparrow. I think they're the kind of birds I saw take. Linda was, I was out with coffee with her and some friends, and she had a pastry, and then a little bird came and just took her pastry. Not just a part of it. It just took her pastry and flew away as far as it could. It was so big that it actually had to land just like 5-6 feet just to torture Linda so she could see the bird only like pick a couple flakes off and then fly away. As I recall what happened, I didn't spend too much time with that. Those are house sparrows. And they make sounds all year long, even in those little shrubs and trees, because, you know, that's where they are. And to me, they sound like, I was pointing out to Todd the other day, I go, oh, that's a house sparrow. That thing that sounds like a ray gun, they sound like, bow, bow. Again, it's just this kind of sound that you just don't want to hear, so you don't hear it. So we're hearing the bird song because now it's stuff that sounds lovely to us. But in the winter, there are these songs, and they're just a little less lovely. So. Yeah, but it is, like I said, really incredible when you tune into it. And they're all doing that at the same time. And it can be so incredibly moving. Like you really hear life, lifing in that moment. It's like, I remember Anne, I'd given a little talk on an author who I really like. And so she read a collection, I think, of his short pieces. And she told me, she goes, it's like reading sunshine. And that's sort of what bird call is like to me. When it's in this time of year, listening to it, it's like sunshine. But hearing sunshine, you know, it's really remarkable. And it's, you know, it's a lovely thing. So anyhow, I could go on about birds longer than probably any of you care to hear. So anything else? Well, thank you all. Hopefully we'll see you downstairs.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.